From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On this week's episode of On Story, we're exploring two of the most popular movie genres, action and comedy. First, we'll hear from the writers behind massive action hits Deadpool, Gone in 60 Seconds, and Armageddon.
For instance, Deadpool is a character that we're writing. He's extraordinarily irreverent and silly and crazy. So, you know, what he does in an action scene is going to be very different from Chuck Norris or Bruce Lee or whatever, just depending on the character.
And later, we'll lighten the mood with a conversation with There's Something About Mary co-writer and director Bobby Farrelly.
A friend of ours had written a script called There's Something About Mary. We rewrote it, you know, using the premise that they had, but putting in a lot of our style of humor.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Action scenes can be some of the most memorable moments in a film, but without a good story to support them, they can fall flat. The most intricately choreographed fight sequence or heart-pounding car chase is only effective if it furthers the story. Machete writer Alvaro Rodriguez spoke with Gone in 60 Seconds and Armageddon writer Scott Rosenberg, Deadpool and Zombieland writer Rhett Reese, and Hulk writer John Turman about writing effective action scenes. Clip of Streets of Fire, courtesy of Universal City Studios, Inc. Clip of Kung Fu Panda, courtesy of DreamWorks Animation, LLC. Clip of Deadpool, courtesy of 20th Century Fox Corporation. Clip of Armageddon, courtesy of Touchstone Pictures.
There seems to be sort of two extremes. There's a sort of minimalist extreme. They fight. Period. The Walter Hill kind of stuff. You've got just the barest bones, and then you have almost like a play-by-play ESPN moment of action sequences. Is there a method to your madness when you're crafting an action sequence? Do you tend to one extreme or the other in writing?
When I saw that my name was on this panel, I laughed because when I did this rather crappy movie called Gone in 60 Seconds, the whole key to the thing was this gigantic chase scene at the end. And I think it was in the original. It was kind of a drive-in movie from the late 60s. And I actually wrote, for days I sort of got to that point, which is around page 70. It was a huge 30-page thing. And for days I put it off, and finally I wrote, listen. I literally wrote this in stage direction, listen. Chase scenes are like sex scenes. The only thing more boring than writing them is reading them. So I'm just not going to do it. And it literally, and Bruckheimer, like it was either brilliant or the most brazenly arrogant, lazy thing of all time.
I love writing action scenes. By contrast, I do the play-by-play. So what you're talking about, it's almost down to the moment. And I think the key is to make sure that if you are going to get that detailed, that the moments themselves are not boring, that they have personality. Because it's one thing if you write, he punches him, he kicks him, he punches him. You know, it's like that's going to be horrifying for a reader. So I do think that if you are going to get detailed, you have to make sure that those details are unique and different and have personality and such. And then I think, to me, it's like a little kid getting to play in the sandbox. You have your setting, you have your toys within that setting that you get to play with, whether they be vehicles or weapons or, you know, they're up on top of a building or, you know, wherever they are. And then you get to have fun playing in the sandbox. So I actually enjoy that part of it and try desperately to avoid, what Scott's talking about, which is just the fact that sometimes the reader does check out a little bit. So it's your job to really grab them by the throat and make sure they don't.
A problem with bad action films, and there are a lot of them, is that the story stops so there can be a chase or a fight, and then it picks up again. And a good one, that's a scene, and the character learns something new about themselves, or it moves the story forward. When I've worked in television, I write them as shot lists, very short. I've always liked how Walter Hill used to write his action scenes. It's really just the essence of somebody doing something.
Is there a difference between the approach that you would take to crafting a fight scene than crafting a chase scene or crafting, you know, things exploding? Is there a different kind of mentality or approach that goes into writing different scenes of action?
I think everybody has to find their own process. You have to connect to the material the way you would write it, not the way someone else would. But a scene's a scene. And so I find that in most scenes, you know, there's the thesis, there's the antithesis, there's the synthesis, and you're done. And the one that I love to give as an example is when Bruce Lee's fighting Chuck Norris. He starts out, and Chuck Norris is the big, strong American, and Bruce Lee is fighting him on his terms, and he's losing. And in the middle of that scene, he sees a cat stretch, and suddenly Bruce Lee starts dancing, and he gets loose and stretchy the way the cat is, and he uses what his advantage is, which is being faster, which is being looser, and he beats him. And to me, that's a perfect example because it's so stripped down. He's trying something. You know, he's got a goal to beat this guy. He tries something, it doesn't work. There's a moment in the scene that through losing, he learns something, he does that, and it works, and you're done.
That leads me to another point about, you know, you talked about using the action scene as more than just, you know, spaces between scenes, but informing the movie and something happening that relates more toward the plot than just, you know, a time killer or time thing.
Yeah, it's funny. My favorite action scene of the last 10 years is actually in Kung Fu Panda. And it's the scene where Po and the master are fighting with the chopsticks over the dumpling. I don't know if you've seen that scene, but what's so wonderful about it is that, you know, you could have done the boring thing. You could have just had them fighting and kicking and punching each other. And instead, he found, the writers, Glenn and John, found this moment of personality and of character, which is that Po loves food. And so his master has tried to reach him by getting through to him through food. So it's like, we're going to fight over this dumpling, and whoever gets the dumpling, who is going to eat the dumpling, wins the scene, basically. And suddenly you've taken a boring scene, and you've given it personality, you've given it life, and you've also given it character. And so you've related your scene and the action to the character. And so I just think it's genius for a lot of reasons. So it's finding a way to advance personality, character within an action scene.
After you, Panda.
Just like that? No sit-ups? No 10-mile hike?
I vowed to train you, and you have been trained. You are free to eat. Enjoy.
Hey!
I said you are free to eat. Have a dumpling. You are free to eat.
Am I?
Are you?
It's got to come out of character. One of my favorites came from Larry Kasdan gave a lecture when I was starting out, and I had attended it, and I was in the back writing notes, and he showed a scene from Bad Day at Black Rock with Spencer Tracy. And it's the scene where Spencer Tracy, you know, has learned that the town is dirty, and he goes in to get a bowl of chili. We haven't seen him eat anything the whole film. We know he's hungry. And Ernest Borgnine starts picking on him, and Spencer Tracy just has like one arm. You've got to see this film. And this scene is fantastic. And he does everything he can to avoid fighting. And he's an older, one-armed man, and Ernest Borgnine is a big, strong, tough bully. And finally, at the point where he can't walk away from it anymore, he beats the shit out of Ernest Borgnine. And it's great because it's a scene and it comes entirely out of character. And the idea that he did everything to avoid that fight. There's another one that I always think of at the beginning of Streets of Fire by Walter Hill, when Michael Paré comes back to town and he's at the coffee shop. We don't know who he is. And some toughs come in and they cause trouble and he ignores them. They cause trouble and they're hassling this waitress and then they bump him and spill his coffee. And now it's a conflict because they bothered him. And one of them takes out a butterfly knife and flips it open and threatens him. And Paré takes it away, flips it, and hands it back to him and says, try again. It tells you everything you need to know about that character and you're on that ride.
After we mess your place up, maybe we'll mess you up. Oh, you got a problem with this pretty boy?
Try it again, punk.
So true. It's literally the only thing I remember from that movie is that scene. Like I can see it frame by frame. I always go to the, again, just as a way of sort of introductory of action characters. I think in Aliens, the scene when they're all in the beginning of the movie and they're all, and the sort of ship is going down to the planet and it's the nastiest, most horrible, and everybody's freaking out and they're all freaking out and Bill Paxton is doing his Bill Paxton thing, and then Cameron sort of pans over to Michael Biehn and he's sleeping, and I was, and just, you know, that is a bad. You know, it's just so great.
And also, I do think that the kind of action you put in has to match the tone of your movie. So, like for instance, Deadpool is a character that we're writing. He's extraordinarily irreverent and silly and crazy. So, you know, what he does in an action scene is going to be very different from Chuck Norris or Bruce Lee or whatever, just depending on the character. So in Deadpool, we've got him fighting some guys in the cab of an SUV, and he takes this guy's head and he starts bashing it against the radio, and every time he does, the radio station changes. So it's a different song, it's El Mariachi. I mean, it's like, it's a mariachi music, and then it's a talk show, and then he grabs the cigarette lighter and he pushes it in, he waits till it gets hot, it pops out, he shoves it in this guy's mouth, he clamps his hand over his mouth, the guy's got this hot cigarette lighter in his mouth. Like, it's insane because the character's insane. Whereas if you were writing a legitimate, you know, kind of serious, needs to be taken seriously movie, your action scene would play very, very differently. So there's a tone to action that can really vary according to movie and according to character.
Go get some.
So you're gonna do a superhero landing. Wait for it. Woo! Superhero landing.
Yeah, that's really hard on your knees.
Totally impractical. They all do it.
You're a lovely lady, but I'm saving myself for Francis. That's why I brought him.
I prefer not to hit a woman, so please play.
I mean, that's why I brought her? Oh, no, finish your tweet. It's not, that's fine. Just give us a second. There you go. Hashtag it.
As a writer, how do you determine that tone? How do you know if you're writing something that's working in terms of that character, in terms of that story?
Probably like Machete, for instance, like you're talking about the machete going through the thing and steering the car, you know, through the back of the seat. Yeah. That's clearly something you would not have done had you been writing, you know, The Godfather. You know what I mean? It's just a different, but you know in your bones kind of what movie you're in here, and you should anyway, and if so, you can just feel what feels right or doesn't.
Yeah, it's the same as a regular scene. Do we learn something new? Do we learn about the character, and does the choice of the scene reflect character and advance the story? If it doesn't, I mean, it's tough when you know you have to have a chase scene and you have nothing in it that's going to tell you something new or advance the character. I hate writing that, and you're stopped cold. You know that you can write the chase scene from point A to point B, but you know it's dead because there's nothing new at the end of that that you didn't know at the beginning. So I look to find that, and then I can usually pull it off.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with our discussion on writing action. When we left off, the writers of Deadpool, Con Air, Hulk, and Machete were discussing balancing tone when writing action sequences. Clip of Armageddon, courtesy of Touchstone Pictures.
If you see Drive, for instance, there's no comedy anywhere in the whole movie. There's not even a hint of a laugh. I do think that comedy and action go well together. I mean, there's a reason action comedy's been a great genre for many years. So you just look for your moments, and you look for characters' reactions to crazy things. I mean, because sometimes something really crazy is happening, and then you just think, geez, how would I react to that? Or how would someone, just even a reaction shot can really be funny.
I mean, when you think of the seminal action movies, sort of in of the last 30 years, that, you know, Lethal Weapon, 48 Hours, and Die Hard, they're all incredibly funny. They all have incredibly funny. They all have very, very funny sort of, the protagonists have a sense of humor. And I think it's incredibly important, again, not to keep talking about my own turgid work, but in the classic film Con Air, where we literally blew up everything, everybody exploded, everybody died, a Corvette got dragged by a plane, the whole thing. Whenever I run into anybody, they always remember the one line when they're all dancing to Sweet Home Alabama, and Steve Buscemi leans over and he said, "Define irony, a bunch of idiots dancing on a plane made famous by a band that died in a plane crash." That is literally, and people quote that to me like verbatim, and I'm like, "But we f-ing blew up Las Vegas. You don't remember that part? What about those fire engines?" So I think humor is, I mean, yippee-ki-yay, mother f-ing. I mean, yeah. Right?
I love Con Air, by the way. So
oh, you're the one.
Stop denigrating that. But I think that the only warning is that make sure that the comedy doesn't undermine the stakes. It can undermine a lot of things, but if it sort of if the comedy undermines what's at stake for the character, if it's a character not taking his own situation seriously, you're killing yourself. And often you may be the only one in that room who can tell the difference between the funny moment that gets a laugh at the expense of the movie versus the funny moment that gets a laugh and adds to the movie.
And it also often falls to one particular character. You mentioned the Bill Paxton character in Aliens. Aliens is not a funny movie by any stretch, but he gets a lot of laughs in that movie because Cameron moved the laughs to that character. I mean, and so he's allowed to be funny in his own way, and the rest of the movie's deadly serious, and that's good. It gives us the release without undermining the stakes.
I just watched the John Carpenter Thing again, just because the new one was coming out, and I just remembered how much I loved it. It's just unbelievably serious and dark, but then in that one moment when the guy turns, when he sees the whole thing, and he's like, "You've got to be kidding me!" Yeah. And it just allows you to it's a great thing, and you sort of need it. It was exactly at the point where it was most necessary.
Is there an approach, or is there a sort of again mentality about balancing the rhythm of the action sequences with the quiet sequences? I mean, how much of that stuff are you consciously aware of when you're crafting the script itself?
I mean, I think you have to be. I worked on Armageddon. There were 9 writers, and I was the 9th. So it was really very close to production, and they sort of brought me in just to punch up some dialogue and write some jokes and do some things, and the action was all kind of set. And I remember reading it and being like utterly bored before I started working, and I really didn't want to do the job, and so I just remember feeling like there was so much action, there was so much going on, there's no room to breathe, and for some reason I'd been that whole I don't know when it was, but the previous few months I've been listening to a lot of Peter, Paul, and Mary randomly, who's this folk trio from the late 60s, and the song Leaving on a Jet Plane, which was like this great song that reminded me of my childhood. So I was like, you know what, I'm going to just totally f*** these guys over. I'm going to write a sequence where they all, because I love when characters just sing randomly, where they all sing goodbye as they're going up to the wherever they were going. They go to the moon or the asteroid or whatever they were doing. And there's that thing, and I remember turning in the pages, and Bay and Bruckheimer like, what the hell is this? I was like, trust me. I like me, trust me, you guys, trust me. And they did, and it's in the movie, and it's completely goofy.
I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye. So kiss me and smile for me. Let me know you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again.
Leaving on a jet plane.
But it was like, it was just, it's sort of exactly what you needed as it sort of got off onto the rollicking thing. So I think it was, you know, it was that thing. It was just literally me reading it with fresh eyes.
Well, I mean, you talked about rock and roll and stuff. I think there is that sense of musicality to things where you have crescendos, you have build up to those moments. Otherwise, it's just a barrage, you know. There's not a lot of investment sometimes if you don't have those in between spaces where character comes through and there's that quiet before the storm because it really hits. I just rewatched Jackie Brown probably for the first time since I'd seen it. And the scene in which Robert De Niro and Bridget Fonda are leaving the mall and she's just needling him, you know, and he turns around and pops her twice, is that just the brutality of that moment and the sort of quiet burn up to that moment and the building up of that moment. The use of those spaces in between before that powerful trigger.
As far as I'm concerned, the best action score of the last 10 years was The Social Network. Like that was, I mean, I remember everybody going in was like, how the hell are they possibly going to make this exciting? And obviously Fincher's brilliant, but it was that score. I mean, that Trent Reznor score, just from the beginning, it was like your blood was, your heart was pumping. It was amazing and it was crazy.
Yeah, that's a film about a guy on the internet and it plays like a thriller.
100%. Yeah. And I do think, I don't know if you guys do this, do you put song choices in your screenplays? Do you just suggest what it should be playing?
All the time.
Yeah, see, I'm the same way. And I just think it's so fun because if it's in your head, go ahead and let it be in the reader's head too. If, you know, it's like, and that could be a choice that's like, straight, like for instance, I put Cypress Hills Rock Superstar in a scene where they're beating the hell out of each other because that's more of an appropriate scene, you know, high adrenaline song. And then I'll go the opposite way and put an ironic one in, like in Deadpool we put in John Denver's "I Want to Live," which is like the silliest, you know, like most beautiful ballad. But it's "I Want to Live" is the lyric, and they're beating out of each other because each one wants to kill the other one. Like suddenly it's an ironic twist. So I'm always looking for a song choice that can help set it off.
Yeah, I tend to have a theory that as people we don't really sense a steady state or speed. We sense changes in state and acceleration or deceleration.
Right.
So the tension and release aspect of it is the action. The action in an action scene is usually right before the action happens or right after the action happens. And so I like that idea of accelerating where, you know, whether it's watching a scene with Joe Pesci slowly melting up, right, you know, or quickly. It's that change in state that really thrills us. And that's why, you know, when I see an action film that's pitched at 10 all the way through, it's boring because, you know, you think that a lot's happening, but nothing's happening. But the change in state to accelerate it and decelerate it, I think it's the only way that we can perceive anything. We just perceive that change.
And the action scenes need to build over the course of the movie, too. So you talk about a crescendo. You've got however many set pieces you end up having in your movie, and you would like the biggest and the best to be at the end, right? And then you'd like probably the second biggest and best to be at the beginning because you got to grab everybody by the throat. But then in between, you want to build a little bit, and you don't want to shoot your wad too quickly in the sense that you'd prefer not to have the movie get anticlimactic toward the end because you've already done all your best stuff. So you do need to almost, in some cases, structure your story around your set pieces. And that sounds a little backward, and I don't want to throw a story overboard because that's the most important thing. But you do want to feel the build, and you want to feel a climax at the end of the movie, and you do that by arranging your set pieces in the correct order.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking about another example. Just recently, it was Drive. The opening sequence of Drive, and it's very minimalist, but it builds tension incredibly. It's a chase scene, I guess, at times, but it doesn't feel like, you know, your ordinary chase scene. It's a really tight and methodical style of writing, but it feels very real as it's happening.
In terms of building, you want that big scene at the end, but it's weird how bigger isn't always bigger in the sense that the end of Indiana Jones, a bunch of us were talking about this, that you'd have a hard time convincing a studio to do Raiders of the Lost Ark. You've got this hero and he's done every sort of cool shit. And at the end of that film, he's tied up and all he does is close his eyes. I mean, that's his action, and it's still action. And true, there's a big scene that is going on around, but to make the mistake of thinking, well, it's got to be big, that means the hero has to do something big.
Right.
And you're thinking, about, this is one of the best films, and he couldn't do anything smaller. And they set that up because of what came before.
I think I mentioned this in another panel, but when we were doing Con Air, and the climax of the script was the plane lands on the Las Vegas Strip, and Bruckheimer was like, we need something bigger. I was like, Jerry, we're just landing the plane on the Las Vegas Strip. Like, how do we? And it was really heated, and it went back and forth, and there were story meetings and story meetings, and finally, I just really was so fed up with the whole thing. I'd written like 70 drafts of this thing, and we were basically done with actually shooting. It was sort of like we were going to go back, and I finally stood up completely as a joke. I go, I tell you what, why don't they all just jump on fire engines and they race through the streets of Las Vegas in a fire engine chase? And he was literally like camera like dollies into his face, and he was like, that's it. And they shot that, and it's and every time subsequently when we previewed it or when we at different screenings and press, like whenever that scene came up after, you know, it's literally like the last 10 minutes of the thing, I would always leave the theater to go, like, because it's so boring to me, and always Jerry was up there and the director was up there. Every one of us had left the theater at that time because clearly you didn't need it. It was just extraneous, but in those days, you had to get bigger and bigger. Every week there was a movie opening that was like Volcano and,
right,
you know, Tornado and, you know, that thing. And so it was all about trying to, and now I think it's better now, in a large part to Zombieland. I mean, I think that was sort of a bit of a sea change, like that. Like, look, you could just make it cool.
Yeah.
And you don't have to make it so big,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I guess that's part of like trying to find that unique twist, you know, doing the fight scene in the truck and doing the fight scene in different places where you'd normally see fight scenes. I remember watching Kill Bill for the first time, and that first fight scene with Uma and Von, I can't remember her name right now.
In the kitchen.
And it's like, oh, right, there's a sort of like displacement. It's like, you know, the style of fighting is like something you'd see with Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris in the stadium, but now it's in this smaller, confined, domestic space that changes the dynamic of the action.
But yeah, looking at all those variables, again, it is like, it's just like writing a scene. And, you know, what's the environment that's going to bring out what the theme of that scene is, or the theme of that sequence, or the theme of the movie, or that character. I mean, you know, I would say, and I don't even know if it's conscious, it probably is, because he's so smart, but Thurman's character was killed getting married. She did not have a family. She did not have that house,
yeah,
and that's where that fight scene happens.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that stuff is why that works.
Yeah.
And I think uniqueness can substitute for size, you know. It's like in the sense that if what you're saying about cool is so important, like if the moment itself is so cool, the audience is like, ah, you know, they don't care whether it's happening, you know, with the stakes of the earth and, you know, the earth falling apart or whatever, that they're locked into the cool at that moment. And so it's just a function of entering your moments and making sure they're unique and cool. And that will be where you find your entertainment value. And the unique and the cool, it's hard to find. Mostly it's just this search for what have I have not seen before? How could I take what could be one thing and just give it that extra little bit? You know, and every time you face it, you're wondering what is it? And all of a sudden something will occur to you and be like, oh, that's it. Like you know, Zombieland 2, we had a similar situation where it was gonna be a fight inside the cab of a truck. A monster truck in this case, which immediately feels big, but it was Columbus fighting a zombie, and so I'm sitting there going, gosh, what could I do to make this better? And then I thought, oh, what about a cop zombie and a prisoner zombie who are attached at the wrist by handcuffs? And now Columbus is fighting two zombies at once. They're connected by handcuffs. So he's like exploring the car, and one of them's flying off the hood, and the other one's still inside, and he's going out here, and then the other one's going out the window on this side. And then ultimately, the two of them are getting, you know, with their handcuffs, are going around the big monster truck tire like this, you know, getting squished, you know, the two of them. And to me, it was like, ah, yes, like there's the uniqueness. Like it's not, the world's not at stake. You know, the earth isn't blowing up. It's not 2012. And yet within the scene, you're trying to find the cool.
I mean, to me, the gold standard in the last few years was, and I mean, you'll all know it when I say it, even though I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was that moment in Wanted where, what did she do? She like swerves the car around and like picks him up. Is that what, is that what it was?
Exactly,
it was like,
exactly.
Again, nothing blew up, nothing exploded. I remember seeing that in the trailer and I was like, I got to go see that movie because clearly this is a director who knows how to make things unique, and these are writers who, and it's Angelina Jolie, and it was badass, and it was amazing, and the whole movie, and the whole movie delivered on that. I thought that was a fantastic movie, because the other problem is, if you only have that one trailer moment, and it's not surrounded by a lot of other good then the audience leaves disappointed. It's like, okay, I saw it, I'm here to see it again, but I saw the tidal wave, you know?
I would add to what we were just talking about is that you have to remember that at the center of every action scene, no matter how big it is a character. And often that's the way into what is unique. If your character at the center of that action isn't under enough pressure, you're not going to feel it's big because it's not big to him.
Do you do anything listening to music or acting out the scene to jog your creativity in order to come up with that twist and your uniqueness in the scene?
I do. Music is a huge part. I always listen to music. I'll put the song in. If it's like a sequence, an action sequence, and I'm thinking like, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, Metallica's da-da-da plays a lot. But it's certainly for listening to me. I mean, for writing, when I'm writing those action sequences, I like to, you know, turn it up to 11 for sure. And getting drunk is good too.
Well, and also you can use score from other movies too. Maybe like I've used that darn Braveheart soundtrack so many times. Just go dum dum dum. You know, it's like I'm like, oh yeah. It just gets me going. So
I think it kind of goes back to this idea that even as professionals, we're still sort of students. We're still learning something new every time out. Every script has its own challenges, and we may go back to the well and look at. You know, I'd look at a scene like in a movie I didn't see at first run because it was in the 50s, but Gun Crazy and the bank robbing scene, and the whole thing is shot one shot from inside the car as they get the getaway stuff, and there's an immediacy to that scene that feels as real as anything that would be in Drive, and you can go back and look at those things and get ideas about how you're crafting your own scene and your story.
I just watched, which I had never seen, Once Upon a Time in the West. The Sergio Leone, it just came out on Blu-ray. The opening of that is insane, and it's just all shots and these, all those Leone close-ups and the whole thing. By the way, you really realize how much he influenced Quentin.
Enter the Dragon was one for me with Bruce Lee. Jackie Chan was more comedy. But I mean, I grew up on James Bond films too. I mean, they would bring them back every year, and I'd ride my bike to Santa Monica for a triple bill. We'd go in like right after breakfast. We'd ride down there, and we'd come out, and it was night, and we didn't know where we were. But I was watching it. I have a son who's 8, and somehow it was the end of Thunderball or something where all the ninjas are coming down, and he's laughing so hard he's almost crying. And I mean, it did have that sense of fun. I teach occasionally now too, and I was talking about this with someone. There's a sense of entitlement, but it's almost like a narrative sense of entitlement. They don't even have to fast forward to get to the good spots now. It's instant. It's all digital. So I mean, I don't know how. I mean, I can't seem to get my kids to watch something in black and white, and I don't know whether I even should be doing it. It's like take your medicine, I tend to find a compelling character. I mean, again, for me, it was Bruce Lee and Enter the Dragon. I mean, it changed my life.
Yeah.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Bobby Farrelly has spent over 20 years redefining broad comedy. Alongside his brother, Peter, the brothers have written and directed cult favorites like Dumb and Dumber, There's Something About Mary, Shallow Hal, and Me, Myself, and Irene. Actor John Merriman spoke with Farrelly at the Austin Film Festival in 2016. Clips of There's Something About Mary, courtesy of 20th Century Fox Film Corporation.
Well, let's jump right in. This is going to be a very casual, very kind of freewheeling discussion just about his career. And why don't we just start with a little bit about how you guys got involved with your first project?
Yeah, my brother Peter and I both, we grew up in Rhode Island and didn't have really anything to do with film whatsoever. I studied geology in college. He studied accounting. Neither of us were very good students, and so we got out. There was no geology job for me, and he wasn't a very good accountant either. So we both went into like sales, and we were kind of floundering back in Rhode Island. Nothing much was happening, and so we both kind of had an idea. Let's try our luck out in California. You know, it seems a lot sunnier and seems more fun out there. We had never really been out there, and so we went out there. And when we got there, we ended up meeting a lot of people who were in the, or trying to get into the film or entertainment business. We met actors and producers and a lot of writers. And while we were there, we were thinking, you know, maybe we should try to write. We didn't want to be an actor. We didn't know how to be a producer or a director, but maybe, you know, we have some good stories from home, so let's give it a shot. And so we literally bought the book, Sid Field's book, Screenplay, which sort of instructs what a screenplay is supposed to look like, some of the do's and don'ts. And we read it, and then we started writing screenplays. And at first, you know, sure, they were no good, but we got better and better, and we thought, hey, this is fun, this is fun. And eventually, like, we started getting people interested in them, and we had a few optioned, and next thing you know, we were getting hired to write screenplays. We hooked up with another partner, I have to mention, Bennett Yellen, so there were three of us. Eventually, it's like it was a little momentum, and we were going and having studio meetings, and we were getting hired to write, and we did that for about 7 or 8 years. Nothing ever got made. We'd get very, very close. We'd get excited. We'd hand in a script, and we think, you know, this is the one. They're going to like it. And the people at the bottom of the totem pole out there did like it, and they'd hand it to the next guy, and he kind of liked it, and then they'd hand it to the next guy, and then they get to the top, and they're like, no. We realized that the people at the top, they don't have any sense of humor at all. So that hurt us as comedy writers. So after about 8 years of doing that, we'd go home back to Rhode Island, and they'd say, what are you doing? You know, what are you guys doing out there? Oh, well, we're writing. Well, have you anything I'd know? Like, nope. No, nothing you'd know at all. Nothing you'd know. Well, what do you mean you're right? Well, that's what we do. We write. I have wait tables, too, and I drive a limo, and I do all that stuff. But really, I spend the most of my time and energy writing. So after about 8 years of that, it was a little frustrating, and we decided to take one of our own scripts that everybody had passed on and that was just lying there on a shelf and nobody was interested in making it. And we thought, maybe we'll do it ourselves as an independent producer. Independent movie. We'll just find someone who knows how to direct. And you know what? We couldn't even find that. Wow. So we met, we had a meeting with John Hughes, a very famous producer who he passed on recently, but he said to us, we were telling him the story, yeah, we've been trying to get things made, and you know, he said, well, why don't you guys direct it? And we're like, what? You know, it hadn't occurred to us that was even a possibility. And he said, well, we don't know how to direct. And he said, well, you wrote it, so if you wrote it, you know the script better than anyone. So just surround yourself with smart people and talented people and find some actors who will deliver the performance that you envisioned when you wrote it. And so we said we will direct it ourselves, and we're going to make a small movie and try to make a very low-budget independent movie from the one script that we thought we could do that we had written, and that was Dumb and Dumber. And so we did. We said we're making this movie, and we started to try to cast it, see if there's any actors who are interested in reading it. And again, we had a lot of people pass on us because they didn't want to be dumb. See, before Dumb and Dumber had come out, the concept of being dumb was like, what? No, I don't. Why would I want to do that? You know, I want to be intelligent. I want to be a smart aleck. I want to be I don't want to be dumb. So that was the idea that most of the actors had, and almost all the agents. Agents wouldn't even give it to their actors because they thought they'd get fired. Anyway, it got in the hands of Jim Carrey. His career just happened to be at the right place at the right time. It was just about to, you know, be shot into outer space, and he read it, and I love this. He met with us, said, I'll do it. And we were there, and we were at the right place at the right time. And Jim's career just, you know, happened to take off right then. He came out with Ace Ventura. And we had him in his next movie, and we were directing. And all of a sudden, you know, the big studios came in, and it went from a small-budget movie to not a small-budget movie. We were going to make it for maybe $100,000, and instead we made it for, I think the budget was $16 million. Jim got $7 million of it. But if you do the math, who's good at math? There was still a lot left for us, and so we were able to hire a really, you know, good crew and cinematographer and all that, and put in good music and that kind of stuff. So we thought sure they'd come in and fire us, right. You know, because they were saying why are we going to let you direct with them? But they never did. They never questioned it. We had never directed a single thing in our life. We hadn't directed a home movie, hadn't directed a commercial, hadn't directed a music video. Had done nothing. But we had, as John Hughes told us, written the script, and we knew where we wanted it to be funny, and we had a better vision of it, and we did surround ourselves with people that we trusted, and we went out and we had a blast making it, and it just, you know, everything took off from there. So that was the beginning of our career. And after that, they were like, what do you guys got next? What else you got in mind? And, you know, that, and it sort of just, you know, took off from there. It wasn't a straight shot, but that certainly was a good boost for us. A friend of ours had written a script called There's Something About Mary, and we loved the premise of what Ed Dechter and John Strauss, two very good writers, and they had this great idea about a guy who's still in love with the girl he had met back in high school, but he had lost touch with, and his buddy convinces him to hire a private eye to try to track her down, see where she is. And the private eye falls for her when he meets her. He's like, she is something else, right? So he falls for her, and he reports back and says, nah, let her go, you know, and so, because he's going to try to steal her.
Got some excellent news for you, my friend.
Oh, yeah? Excellent.
I think your life's about to change.
Really? So you found her?
Oh, yeah. And you were right, man. She really is something else.
Oh, my God. Really? So she hasn't changed at all, huh?
Well, that I couldn't say. Let me ask you something. Was Mary a little big boned back in high school?
And that was the premise of the script. And they got it into the studio system, and they started getting a lot of studio no's. And we love that idea. I was like, that's a funny idea. But they got it into the studio system again, and they started getting notes from all sorts of executives. And it went from a good idea to, like, it was killed. It was development hell, you know? It got to the point where we didn't like Mary in the script. It's like, and they agreed. They, you know, I'm not saying like they messed it up. It was messed. They had to go down that road. So it died. It died on the vine. We went to them and said, hey, you know, remember that idea that you had, that script? Would you mind if we took that and rewrote it and tried to, you know, kickstart that again? And they were like, yeah, it's dead. Do it. So my brother and I took it, and we rewrote it, you know, using the premise that they had, but putting in a lot of our style of humor, you know, and so that was a big hit for us too.
So your first movie, you guys write and direct, but since then you've written things that you haven't directed.
We co-direct. We sit at the monitor together, and we share our thoughts, and then one or the other will go relay those thoughts to the actor or to the crew where needed, but we're not looking to make those kind of movies where people say, oh my God, did you see that camera move? That was, you know, that one shot lasted 6 minutes, or, you know, you'll never hear, or how did they do that thing where they pulled out and he got closer, and like, because we don't know how to do that.
Right.
But we don't want to do that either, because we want to, you know, where we look at ourselves as storytellers. And any time in one of our movies that somebody in the audience broke frame and thought, oh, that was a good camera move, that sort of thing, we think that we've done an injustice to the story. You just want to watch the story and follow the story. That's all.
Right.
Forget that there's a camera there. Forget that there's a crew over here and that there's lighting people and all that kind of stuff. So that's our philosophy on that, is that just it's all about the performance.
So after doing Dumb and Dumber, did that inform how you approached writing in the future? Were there things that you had written that, oh, okay, this actually doesn't work as well on set, or this bit that we thought would be really funny is somehow not working with the actors?
That definitely does happen, where you'll get to a movie, you'll say, geez, at the end you'll think, boy, I would have, bet that this one bit was going to kill, but it never did. And this other one that you didn't think much of, all of a sudden gets a huge laugh. That happens all the time. But there's no way to know. It's not like after you've made one or two movies, you're smarter, so you know which ones are going to work. You still don't know.
Right.
So it didn't change much. No, you still have to try a lot of different things and see which ones work. And when you start showing it to people, you realize, oh, this joke is really performing, or the audience really likes this one character, or something happens that you didn't quite, know going in. And then you have to try to re-edit the movie. Now I'm a director doing this, so you have to try to re-edit the movie in a way that brings out those things, that makes that bit, funnier, or that person a bigger character.
Do you write for actors? Do you have actors in mind when you're writing script, even if you don't eventually cast them?
When we wrote Ben Stiller's character and There's Something About Mary, we certainly did not have Ben Stiller in mind. We just had a guy and a character in mind that Ben Stiller ended up playing perfectly. Right. He just played it exactly like we had imagined, but we certainly were not thinking of him, but he was the right guy for it. When we were casting There's Something About Mary, and we had Cameron Diaz, and we knew that she was definitely something special. She had only been in a couple of movies. She had been in The Mask, just a smaller role, but when she was just that person, she was just popping. And we were very happy to have her play Mary. We're thinking, who can play the Ted character, the main lead? And we auditioned many, many, many guys. And our final three were Ben Stiller, Owen Wilson, and Jon Stewart. And they were all up-and-comers,
Wow. I heard that in another interview that you guys were inspired by Bottle Rocket when you were writing There's Something About Mary.
That's true, yeah. There was a lot of times when we were just like, you get stuck. Like, where are we going with this? You hit a little block, like you don't quite see where you're going. And that's a good thing. So we were at one of those blocks, and my brother Pete had came in one day, when we were going to have our writing session, and he said, I saw this movie last night, and he goes, I want you to see it before we even write. And we went out and saw, I can't remember, he must have had a VHS of it or something, right. But it was Bottle Rocket with the two Wilson brothers, and it was very, very, I don't know if you guys have seen it. They might have shot it right here.
Yeah, as I remember, you guys were sort of feeling like, oh, the audience, it's a foregone conclusion that Mary's going to get with the Ben Stiller character. And so maybe that opened up your eyes to like, oh, well, we're just going to see where it goes.
If any time you write a romantic comedy, the formula is boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy wins girl back. And there's very few deviations from that,
right.
Unless it's the exact opposite girl, But that's what happens. And it is a formula. So you can't just write it like that and try to hang jokes on it. You have to go to places where the audience doesn't know you're going, where you got to do something different, because everyone knows that story. And so that's what was going to happen in our story, probably. But one of the things that we did is we said, we have to keep open the possibility that Ted doesn't, that he doesn't get her at the end, because that'll free us up to a lot of different things. Maybe it's better somehow that she goes with someone else.
Right.
And so it would be like, he loved her so much he'd let her go, And so we did think along those lines. And we as we were writing it, we really did consider that maybe the Brett Favre character is the right guy. Maybe, it's just leave open those possibilities. And, as we wrote the story, fortunately for us, it did come back that he did, get her at the end. But as writers, we kept open every possibility.
What kind of movies inspired you growing up? Were you a huge comedy fan always? Who were your guys, actors?
Where we grew up was very rural, and we didn't even have a movie theater in the town. So we watched a lot of things like on TV, and the only time you'd see a movie would be like the late movie on TV. I'm dating myself, going back a few years, but there weren't as many channels. And So you'd watch a movie on TV, and yeah, there were a bunch of movies that we'd see that we really liked. But they were always silly, goofy movies like Ski Party and Cat Ballou. Cat Ballou was a great movie. They used to show it a lot, and we loved that movie. Jane Fonda. But more TV shows.
Yeah.
You know, TV shows. And the one that really moved us, and, you know, we've definitely told this story a few times, is that it was the Andy Griffith Show. And the reason why it did is, one of the reasons why it did is because when we used to get together every day for writing, our writing partner, Bennett, was at his house. He had a routine where he wanted to take a nap every day for a half an hour in the afternoon.
That's a good
writers
routine.
Are lazy, right? So we're like, okay, all right, we'll take a break. You know, I think it was an hour, actually. And it was right around 3:30. He'd think, yeah, I'm ready for a nap. If you go, all right. So he'd go upstairs to his bedroom, and Pete and I would go over and sit on his couch and watch TV. And at 3:35 on the West Coast, it would be 6:35 East Coast, the Andy Griffith Show came off with back-to-back episodes on TBS. And so we'd always watch two episodes. And we had watched them when we were young, too. But there was just something about it, the way they blended real-life drama and pathos and all that. When Andy was talking to Opie, that was a real father and a real son with real issues and real lessons, and Aunt B and all that, and it was a real family. And, you know, then Barney would come in, and he'd be like comic relief, you know?
Right.
So the way that they blended real stuff with comedy was just brilliant, you know? They do a whole show where there wasn't really very much comedy at all. In fact, it was very heartfelt. You know, like Opie had, to learn a lesson was the one where he was telling a story about some imaginary guy, some guy he had met in the woods, and he was some fantastical person who could blow smoke out his ears and all sorts of things. And Andy was like, okay, stop telling that story. That's, you know, that you know it's not true. And well, it is true. And so Andy and the son end up having a standoff, and Barney, as wrong as he always is, he's saying, you gotta really, you gotta take that kid out behind the woodshed, you know, teach him a lesson. You gotta start nip it in the bud right here. And he said, no, I'm not, no. Like, well, how can you possibly believe that story? And he said, I don't believe that story. Mr. McGreevy was the guy's name. I don't believe in Mr. McGreevy, but I believe in Opie, right? And so I'll just go with that. And you find out later, well, there was a guy, he was a telephone repairman who did all these stupid tricks and all that. And so Opie was right. But it was like, there wasn't a joke in that episode. And it was a really good episode. And there were a lot like that. But then there'd be other ones where it was all jokes. And that's just a style that we took to heart. So it had more to do with TV for us than, say, the old classics, you know, the Billy Wilders and all those kind of things.
Right.
I don't really know those movies.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, Maya Perez, and Brian Ramos. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.